Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Ecclesiastes is after the Psalms and the Proverbs. This is the wisdom literature. This is a book about the meaning of life. So many people seek their meaning in knowledge. They think, if I get a college education, I will have arrived. Or in work, if I get that position, I will have attained. Or in pleasure, as we're going to look at tonight in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. If I could just fulfill all of my dreams, then I would truly be happy. Have you ever turned on the television in the middle of the night when you couldn't sleep and had these amazing shows that say, you know, if you get this exercise equipment or this facial cream, you will be happy. You will be young again. They almost promise eternal life. And it's only 10 payments of 1995. And you'll be healthy, wealthy, and wise. We all know that no one can deliver on the promises, and that's exactly Solomon's point in the book of Ecclesiastes. No one can deliver satisfaction and happiness outside of the Lord. That's his point. Now, in case you don't believe me, listen to wise Solomon, because in Ecclesiastes, say that 10 times real fast. No, don't. Chapter 2 says he's going to have an experiment in which he has all resources, all the time, all the power, and he's going to do whatever his imagination brings him to do. He's going to find pleasure through parties in chapter 2, through productivity, and through prosperity, and at the end, he's going to find it to be completely without value. Look at verse 1 of chapter 2. Solomon says, I said in my heart, go to now, I will prove thee, or I will test you with mirth. And the word mirth, according to the Old Testament word book, it means joy, gaiety, or pleasure. So I'm going to test you with pleasure, therefore enjoy pleasure, and behold, this is what? This also is vanity. It's vanity. It's meaningless. It doesn't have value. It doesn't hit the core of your being. In other words, there's always a ceiling to anything that this life has to offer. There is pleasure in sin. There is pleasure even in the things of this world, but it's only for a season, and it's only to a certain point. It cannot satisfy the soul. There's a ceiling under the sun. And so you can't even imagine the things that Solomon begins to explore. We find out, first of all, that he has some gigantic banquets and parties. Now, there are lots of people in this world that think, you know, if I could just have the freedom not to work and party all night long and all day long and eat whatever I wanted to eat and have all the music that I wanted, then I would be happy. Well, you don't have to do that experiment because Solomon already did. Solomon says in verse number 2, he begins his experiment with parties. Pleasure through parties. I said of laughter, it is mad. It's crazy. And of mirth, what doeth it? Or what good is it? I sought in mine heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting mine heart with wisdom. In other words, he gave himself to wine. All the while, he acquainted himself with wisdom, trying to find out if it really satisfied. He never set aside his goal of trying to prove whether or not pleasure could really satisfy. He was always engaged, even while he was drinking, even while he was partaking in these banquets. So, He was acquainting his heart with wisdom, verse 3, to lay hold on folly, he says, till I might see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. He says, I gave myself to pleasure. I gave myself to wine. His motto was very similar to the one that could be reduced to six single syllable words that's very popular today. If it feels good, do it. That's what he tried. That's what he went after. Anything that felt good. And so he goes on his experiment. Turn over to 1 Kings chapter 4. We're going to look at the size of his banquets. But before that, let's look at the mirth of his banquets. The comedy. He said in verse 2, I said of laughter, it is mad. In fact, he laughed so hard day after day after day after day. He laughed and he laughed and he laughed some more. And after he was done laughing, he says, according to verse 2, it was all vanity. All vanity. It didn't fulfill me. Okay, having said that, turn over to 1 Kings chapter 4, and we're going to check out the size, the massiveness of Solomon's banquets. 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 22, and Solomon's provision for one day was 30 measures of fine flour. Now, I have seen anything from 1,000 to 6,000 liters being the actual measurement of this flour. But anyway, it was a whole lot of flour, and 60 measures of meal, 10 fat oxen, 20 oxen out of the pastures, and 100 sheep. Beside that, deer, or harts, roebucks, which are male deer, and fallow deer. I looked this up. This is a beautiful deer that has like moose antlers. It's just gorgeous, but they're real fat and they're great to eat. And they dwell in that land. And fatted fowl, this would be something like quail or chicken or hens or partridges. They were having a feast. Now this was for how long? What does it say? One day. This was for one day. The commentators estimate that Solomon would have hosted between 15 and 20,000 people every day. This would have included his royal court, his family, and many friends. And this was an experiment, taking it back to Ecclesiastes 2, he said that he partied for a long time. He went to experiment with wine and pleasure and folly and laughter for a long time. So I'm telling you, if they had comedians, he brought them out every night. I mean, the sitcoms, he didn't watch it on television. He brought the guys and paid them to act right in front of him. He had unlimited resources and he just enjoyed himself as far as human joy can go. So if you think that, you know, he lived way back then and he didn't know what he was doing, we have much more today. Listen, there's nobody that had the wealth like Solomon had, that had the power like Solomon had. And he brought it in. He brought in the best of the best. He also brought in, it says, he brought in singers. He brought in singers in verse 8. We'll get to that. But I'm telling you, he tested pleasure through his banqueting, through his partying. Secondly, he tested pleasure through productivity. I mean, after the 50th or 100th or 200th party, and he's waking up and not knowing where he's at and tired, and another day of partying, it got old. And so we read in verse 4 that he moves to something new. He moves to productivity. I know what I'll do. I'll make something of myself. I'll stop being so self-centered. I will make something of myself. In verse 4, he says, I made me great works. I builded me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards. I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. I made me pools of water. In other words, he made irrigation ponds. To water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. I got me servants and maidens and had servants born in my house. Also I had great possessions of great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me. He had so many servants he didn't have to do anything for himself. He was on a ranch. He had cattle and horses and he could do anything he wanted to, anytime he wanted to. Not only that, verse 8, I gathered me also silver and gold and the peculiar treasure of kings and of the provinces. I mean, he got these strange treasures and jewels that nobody else could even look at. He bought them. And then he says, I got me men singers and women singers and the delights of the sons of men as musical instruments. And that of all sorts. He didn't have an iPod. He bought the band. He brought them over. He listened to them. Anyone he wanted to. Anytime he wanted to. He had it all. You know, you cut your grass and you sit back with that iced tea on your porch. You look at that garden you planted. And you know, Solomon appreciates your roses and your petunias. But man, that was nothing compared to what he had. He didn't just have a garden. He had forests of different exotic fruit trees, it says. He had all kinds of things that we couldn't even dream of. Check out the map on the back of your handout. And if you don't have one, just raise your hand. We'll get one to you. This is Solomon's palace. When it says he builded houses, it's talking about this great campus. And you'll notice on the map, number 9 is the temple. And all the way around this is Solomon's palace. And he's got his own hall of pillars, hall of judgment, his royal palace, a place for the harem. He's got all kinds of things. He's building houses and places for his 700 wives and 300 concubines. This guy, it took 7 years to build the temple. This guy took 14 years to build his campus, his palace. He had everything. Anything he dreamed of, he did it. He had a test of pleasure and productivity. And he had the satisfaction of looking at these amazing buildings going up, this amazing campus, and he just sat there and he said, go here and do this. And not only that, he had servants. And it says his servants had servants. In other words, he didn't have to put his hand to his nose if he sneezed. If he didn't want to feed himself breakfast, he just had people feed him. Anything he wanted to eat, any time of the day or night, he didn't have to do a thing. If he wanted something built, he dreamed it up and he told somebody to go build it. And Solomon's irrigation ponds, which we read about in verse 6, if you go southwest from where this palace would be, the temple dome of the rock, where the Muslims built right on the venue of Solomon's temple. If you go southwest from there, you'll find these caverns that would have held water. These were the irrigation ponds of Solomon that are talked about right here. Now turn back to Ecclesiastes 2. And we come to a third experiment. This experiment of prosperity and ease. Mentioned about the servants, but it says in verse 8, I gathered me also silver and gold, peculiar treasures. And he got men singers and women singers and delights of the son of men as musical instruments. He had everything. And not only that, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines that we'll read about later. But in other words, kings at this time had they lived sensually, however they wanted to live. And Solomon pursued this. He built houses for his harem. And you say, why do you bring that up, Pastor? This is a Christian church. I bring it up because God made pleasure. And when you use pleasure outside of the bounds that God designed it for, you're going to create a disaster. Now let's talk about pornography. You say, that is a scary word. We shouldn't talk about that in church. We should talk about it because it's everywhere. In case you haven't looked at a billboard or at a commercial on television, softcore pornography is everywhere, and you need to guard your eyes from it. It's everywhere. You can't look at a dish soap commercial without this kind of stuff being put right into your life and in your mind. Now, the word pornography, what is it? Porne means immorality, and graph means to portray. And so, pornography is about picturing, imaging, imagining, fantasizing about immorality. Now, God made one man for one woman for life, right? Till death do you part. If you're married, you're to stay married to that person, and you're to be satisfied with that person until death. And to imagine that you could do anything with anyone outside of your marriage is porneia. It's immorality. The Bible calls it fornication. It's uncleanness, according to the Scriptures. And it's everywhere. It's not just on the billboards, it's on the television, it's in our clothing. You can go to Walmart, you can go down various aisles and see softcore pornography. You say, well, Solomon, he was a pervert. Well, there are men today, many men, even within our churches, that view pornography and they struggle with it. And we need to confront that because it's before us all the time. And these images are available at the click of a mouse. And many times these things are brought in through very innocent means. And somebody clicks on something as a young man, and they don't know what they're clicking on, and all of a sudden they're in a world that enslaves them. And this takes place in the lives of young people and enslaves them into their 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s. And even if they don't seek the Lord in this matter, it can enslave them their whole life. Now, what's the solution? What is the solution for pornography? Well, first of all, it's self-control. Under the power of the Holy Spirit, you have to learn how to think. You have to learn what to think upon. And the Bible has all kinds of things that tell us how to think and what to think about. And you need to fill your mind with those things, and you need to learn how to control your mind. Now, it's not wrong to be tempted with an image. But listen, if you keep feeding yourself images after image after image, you're going to continually be enslaved to that. Now, if you cut it off, you're still going to be tempted because those images are in your mind. But there's hope. As you put in God's Word can cleanse your mind. It's like taking a spiritual shower. And as you walk close with God, I'm not saying you're going to have perfect victory. You're going to struggle, but you're going to make some progress and you're going to see change in your life. So before we start pointing our finger at Solomon for all he had, why don't we point the finger at ourselves? Because Jesus said, if you look on a woman to lust after her, you've what? You commit adultery already in your heart. Now, if you're struggling with this, don't think that you're not a Christian. Listen, Christian men struggle with this, and you can have victory over it. Some of it is remnants from your former life, and you still have these habits, and what you need to do is put off the old man and put on the new man. Self-control. But there's a second thing. A healthy marriage will help you. Now, a marriage is not the solution to pornography. You first need to have self-control in the Spirit of God. Walk with God closely. Some men think, well, if I just get married, marriage will take over. No, because your wife cannot compete with 700 images online that have no flaw. What we need to look at is self-control and getting a realistic understanding of what God has for us as men and women for the marriage bed. Hebrews tells us that The marriage bed is undefiled, but whoremongers and adulterers God will judge. But turn over to 1 Corinthians 7, verses 1 through 7. 1 Corinthians 7, verses 1 through 7, because we're talking about how pleasure outside of Christ will really not fulfill you. Pleasure outside of Christ will really not fulfill you. It didn't fulfill Solomon, and it won't fulfill you. But what will fulfill you is walking with God, but secondarily, and I mean this is not the primary thing. The primary thing is to walk with God. But secondarily, a healthy marriage will help you. It is better to marry than to burn. That doesn't mean that marriage takes away all of your need for self-control. There are many times in a married couple's life where the woman is not able. She's physically set aside for a while after childbirth and many other things that we won't get into tonight. But look at 1 Corinthians 7 and verses 1 through 3. It says, "Now concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman." And that's speaking of intimacy. "Nevertheless, to avoid fornication," to avoid porneia, that's the word there, "let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband." Now look at this, verse 3. You could miss what Paul is trying to say, because he's saying something in a very discreet way, but it's very important that we get the point. "Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence," due kindness, "and likewise also the wife unto the husband." What is he talking about? He's talking about intimacy. And he's saying it's a very kind thing that the husband use his body to satisfy his wife, and the wife use her body to satisfy her husband. It's a kind thing because not everyone is on the same drive, so to speak. Now, verses 4 through 7, "The wife has not power over her own body, but the husband, and likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body, but the wife." In other words, if you're married, men, you should use your body. That doesn't just mean intimacy. It means all day long. It means you can write love letters to your wife as soon as you get up. You can call her on the telephone. You can help her to remember that you love her and that she's in the arms of protection all day long, and you care about her. That's what we need to do as men. And the wife and the husband use their lives and their bodies to be kind and to please each other. I would tell you that 1% of married life is that intimacy that we think about in the marriage bed. It's about 1% of the intimacy of marriage. But look at the next verse, verse 5, because it does talk specifically about the marriage bed. It says, defraud ye not one the other, except it be with consent for a time, that ye may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency," your lack of self-control. Now, scientifically and physically, you will find that about every 3 to 5 days, a man and woman and married need to be together. About every 3 to 5 days, a man will become extremely irritable. Okay? And that is because he's starting to lose his self-control. And he needs to be with his wife. Now, ladies, if you're married, you need to care for your husband. And you ought not to defraud him anytime he asks. You should, if you're able, be with him. Now you say, why are you talking about this? Because I'm reading the Bible here, and these are very important things that we need to be aware of. So, realize this. If you're dealing with fantasies and imaginations in your mind, your spouse is not the answer. Because all you'll do is bring that filth into the marriage bed. Don't do that. If you've got pornographic images in your mind and wrong things in your mind, you need to cleanse your mind with the Word of God, and you need to walk with God and learn self-control. Having said that, once you're walking with God, there's nothing more fulfilling, if your heart is right with God, than a healthy marriage and a healthy marriage relationship. And you're never going to have a healthy marriage relationship unless you have a healthy relationship with God. You've got to walk close with God. All right. I said all that to say this. Pleasure outside of Jesus Christ is empty. If you put pleasure in the place of God and pleasure becomes your God, you're going to be an addict. And you're going to keep going after that pleasure, but it's never going to fulfill you. It might be comedians. You can watch comedian after comedian after comedian. You can watch movie after movie after movie. You can watch sitcom after sitcom after sitcom. And it's not going to satisfy you. You can have party after party after party. You can have dream after dream after dream. You can build house after house. You can rule the world practically. It's not going to satisfy you. Pleasure in any matter is not going to satisfy you unless it's funneled through your relationship with Jesus Christ. And then there's all kinds of pleasures that God has for us. He invented pleasure. And He gave it to us as a gift from Him. But let's bridle it in the right way. Look at Solomon's conclusions, beginning with verse 9. So I was great. In other words, I was popular. I wonder why he was so popular. And increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem, and also my wisdom remained with me. He never forgot his goal. He never forgot his experiment. His wisdom remained with him. He was going after pleasure to prove pleasure was empty, to show that it was empty. Verse 10, and whatsoever mine eye desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy. For my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my portion of all my labor. What's he saying? Is he contradicting himself? Absolutely not, because he's going to say something in verse 11. But in verse 10, let's not minimize this. There is a real seduction to pleasure, and that's what he's talking about in verse 10. Pleasure is awesome for a time. It's amazing for a time. You go after it, there is pleasure in sin for a season. If it wasn't so amazing, the majority of the world wouldn't be going after it, selling their soul for it. Be careful about pleasure, because it can become your God, but it will never satisfy. Because in the end, we come to the conclusion that Solomon did in verse 11. Then I looked on all the works of my hands that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. Come on, you know what that vexation of spirit is. You get up, there's that heaviness, and you might be at the center of the world, but something is not right in your soul. And you get it all, you can just have that thing right in your soul. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his own soul? What shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Eternity is what we're talking about. And when we come to Christ, all the good things that God gives in their right place begin to make sense. God invented sex. He invented food. He invented joy. He invented laughter. And it's all wonderful lived in relation to God. We close by saying this. There was a man who was talking about the destruction that people enter into when they give themselves freely pleasure outside of God's restraints. And he had a beautiful robe. Fresh rose, huge rose. And he said, look at this beautiful rose. What I want you to do is I want you to touch it, handle it, throw it out to the congregation of about 1,000 people. And he began to talk about the destruction that occurs when you give yourself to pleasure outside of God's fences. And that rose went around and people touched it and they handled it and they smelled it. And finally, at the end of the message, somebody threw the rose back up on the platform and picked it up, and there it was, all messed up and all torn apart. And he held up and he said, who? Look at this rose. Who would ever want a rose like this? It's all messed up and dirty. And I want you to know tonight who wants that rose. Jesus Christ wants that rose. Jesus wants that rose. Because that rose is all of us, by the way.
We've all given ourselves like that rose to the world. Haven't we? And we're all messed up. We're all broken up. We're all part of the fall. And we need to get ourselves in the hands of Jesus, who can transform us and fulfill us and restore us and make us into the image. If we give ourselves the pleasure, we're going to destroy our lives.